What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping
you? I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
I'm going to make the same mistake I made yesterday. I'm going to go through my paces before we get into the rest of the show. Welcome to EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. It's a show that's it's intended primarily for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters, but we will take questions from anybody who has one. Perhaps you're in conversation with a non-Catholic and they've posed a question to you that you had a hard time answering. We'd love to help you out with that. Just give us a call at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you are a non-Catholic, then the question we're asking you is, what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic? Or have you even considered becoming a Catholic? If you're outside the United States and Canada, we'd love to hear from you as well. Your number is 1-205-271-2985, and we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. Excuse me. That's where you jump in with witty repartee. You can also send us an email. The email is ctc@ewtn.com. I haven't spoken in a couple of hours. Can you tell?
You get rusty pretty fast.
You do. I'm Jack Williams, sitting in today for Tom Price, who's probably speaking more clearly than I am right now. Charles Beery producing the program. Your call screener is Matt Gubensky, and Ace McKay handling our social media efforts. Rich Jesse handling our social media efforts today. So if you're watching us on YouTube or Facebook Live, you can type a question into the chat window, and it may find its way to us by the end of the program. And our host, the one and only Dr. David Anders, how are you?
Jack, doing great. How about you?
Terrific, thanks. Got an email here from Bonnie. She says, Dr. Anders, I am a cradle Catholic. I keep hearing other people say the Catholic Church created their own rules, and Catholicism is not from the Bible. Does Catholicism come from the Bible and or from the Pope who intercedes with God? I need a good explanation to give to these folks.
Okay, thanks. I really appreciate the question, although I do think the question sets up a false dichotomy, which is that either Catholicism proceeds from the Bible or it's made up its own rules without divine sanction. There's another alternative, and that is that the Bible was produced by the Catholic Church, not the other way around, right? And that is actually the truth of the matter, that Christ nowhere in his public ministry talked about handing on a book that would be the repository of all wisdom or knowledge or a rule of faith for the Christian faithful. Rather, Jesus appointed individuals, people, not texts, but individuals, people, and said, go into all nations, make disciples, and I'll be with you to the end of the age. That's Matthew 28. That's the promise of divine assistance. I'll be with you to the end of the age. It means I will accompany you. And whatever you bind on earth is bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth is loosed in heaven. Whoever hears you, hears me. Whoever rejects you, rejects me. Whoever sins you, forgive, are forgiven. Whoever sins you, retain, are retained. This is all very powerful language that Christ invests not in a book, but in human individuals. And those individuals, in turn, appointed successors to their ministry. They appointed priests in all the churches that they founded, and they appointed others to take over this apostolic ministry and to appoint others in turn. That's what we call apostolic succession. So the provision that Christ made for handing on the faith wasn't the Bible. It was actually the living magisterium of the teaching church. Now, over time, what happened is the church began to gather together texts that she venerated and held as sacred and understood to be inspired. But there was no mandate from the physical ministry of Jesus that they do so. This was under the church's own prudential wisdom to gather these texts together into a collection, and by the late 4th century to promulgate them as a single canon of a book called the Bible. But that was a process that took time, took centuries, in fact, and is a product of Catholic tradition. So if you don't have the Catholic Church, if you don't have Catholic tradition, you don't have the Bible. you don't have the Bible. And so, of course, the church doesn't emerge from the Bible. The Bible emerged from the church. That's how it goes. Now, to the question, did the Catholic Church make up rules for itself? Yes, of course. Absolutely it did. Every church makes up rules for itself. So you wander into the most Bible-alone Baptist church that, in rural Alabama that you want to go to, and I guarantee you there are rules, written or unwritten, that the members of that church body follow. Like, for example, the women's Bible study meets on Thursday nights, and the men's Bible study meets on Tuesday nights. It's an unwritten rule. Maybe it's a written rule. Maybe it's published in the bulletin. Or, you know, if you want to contact the pastor, follow this protocol. These are rules, and of course they exist, and you have to have them to run any kind of organization. Now, when the organization is as large as the Catholic Church, encompassing, you know, not the Fish Fry and the Women's Bible Study and Knitting Society, but a billion people throughout the world, obviously the collection of rules, as it were, to govern this community's corporate life has to be a lot more complex. There aren't many nations, well, maybe only one or two nations on the planet, that are as populous as the Catholic Church. And compared to, say, the United States or Great Britain or China or India, I would venture to say that the Catholic Code of Canon Law, which is a list of the rules, is probably greatly simplified. In fact, I know it is. You can get a copy of the Code of Canon Law and hold it in one hand quite easily. It doesn't even make a good doorstop. It's not quite big enough. Try to do that with the U.S. Federal Code.
Or the tax code.
Or the tax code alone. Just the tax code alone. You know, my father was a tax attorney. And, you know, first few years out of law school and in practice, he actually attempted to fill out his own tax forms. And one of his clients was an accountant. One day, the accountant walked into my father's office, and Dad is like, you know, 6 feet deep in paperwork filling out his taxes. And the guy who was a buddy of my father's just walks over to my father's desk and starts dumping all the papers in a cardboard box. And he turns to my dad, whose name was Louis. He says, Louis, you may be an expert in the law. You're not an expert in filling out the forms. I'm an expert in filling out the forms. I'm doing this for you. And that's how he got his accountant.
833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number. It is a free telephone call anywhere in North America. 833-288-3986. And you can now text your question again. You can text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. It's EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. You know, there's lots of great apps that are out there available in cyberspace for you these days. One of the best ones I've come across in a long time is Laudate. And along with great Catholic content on that app, you can listen to EWTN Radio's live stream. Just open the Laudate app and then click on EWTN. 833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. First up today is Donald in Central New Jersey listening on Domestic Church Media. Donald, thanks for holding. Welcome to the program.
Yes, well, thank you. For Dr. Anders, Jesus is known as the Lamb of God. Now, on the original Passover, when the Jews put the blood of a lamb over their threshold, the door, did they also eat the lamb? Because I know Jews weren't allowed to drink blood. And because Jesus offers blood in the Paschal sacrifice, the new Paschal sacrifice, I'm wondering how you compare the two and give some connections as well.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So, as a practical matter, it is impossible to consume meat without consuming some kind of blood. Just press on your steak one night and see what happens, you know. But there is a ritual form of slaughter that was mandated in the Old Testament to drain blood from the corpse, and that was necessary for the meat to be considered appropriate for consumption. And then, of course, Jews did eat meat, including the Passover lamb, which was ritually purified of blood, but, you know, I'm sure there were remnants of it that remained. It's almost impossible to get rid of it. Now, the analogy to Jesus, of course, is made throughout the New Testament, as Jesus is the Passover sacrifice, and his His Last Supper with his disciples, and of course his death on Calvary coincided with the Jewish Passover, and the parallelism, the analogy is quite obvious and to be understood, that Jesus is the fulfillment of all of the sacrificial system of the Old Covenant, which is why the book of Hebrews says that having sacrificed the perfect Lamb of God, that there's no longer any need to continually make atonement in the temple in Jerusalem, and we can rest content with the sufficiency of Christ's one sacrifice.
Thanks, Donna. We appreciate the phone call today. 833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. Sandy in West Virginia writes in, "Dear Dr. Anders, serious sin has sadly been a big part of my life. I have confessed and will continue to confess frequently. It is the attachment to sin which concerns me most as I approach my 80s. Could you please discuss this and possibly recommend any readings which could help me lose my attachment to my sins? I'm a daily listener and very much appreciate all you do to guide souls." And that's Sandy, and she's listening on the EWTN app.
Okay, thanks. I really appreciate the question. And my first response on hearing your email was, you too, huh? You know, serious attachment to sin, I think, is a problem for most of us. Now, you know, here's a place where I think that a modern scientific worldview can actually help us. And this is, the church has always done this. The church has always availed itself of the best science and psychology in dealing with the problem of sin. St. Thomas does it. He deals with Aristotelian philosophy, Aristotelian psychology, in his account of the virtues. And I think we can do the same and draw some insights. And the kinds of sins that most people are drawn to, particularly the sins of the flesh, well, there's a specific neurology for that, right, that underlies human action. And you read all the time these days about the dopamine system in the brain and the kinds of activities that trigger craving and so forth. And what the literature on habit formation tells us and the neurology on habit formation is that once you form a bad habit, once you form any habit, in fact, you can never get rid of it. I mean, that's what the scientific data seems to show. It's one of the reasons why addicts who may have been abstinent for 30 years, you know, an alcoholic, for example, can never safely drink again. And what experience and the scientific data show is you may have been sober for 30 years, but the alcoholic that goes back and thinks, well, I'll just have a single glass of wine, he goes right back to his addiction, and he goes back to the stage of his addiction where he last left off. So he may have started as an occasional drinker, a social drinker, and then he moved up to a daily drinker, and then he was getting blackout drunk every time he got up. Well, when he goes back to the addiction, even after 30 years, he goes right back to being blackout drunk. He doesn't start at ground zero again. And because you kind of carve these neural pathways in your brain, and they don't ever go away. What you have to do instead is lay down new habits on top of them. The old habits never go away. They're always there sort of latent, and you can resurrect them at a moment's notice. But you have to lay down new pathways on top of them. And I think that's, from the level of natural virtue, that's what we have to learn how to do. And Catholic spiritual practice is really all about laying down those new habits. So let's say bad behavior always begins in the mind, right? Always begins in the mind. There's always some kind of trigger that sets in motion a habit pattern that leads to some kind of expected reward. And, if your weakness like mine is pecan pie, you know, somebody, lovely lady, sent me a pecan pie in a jar just the other day. So thank you very much if you're listening for that pecan pie in a jar. But, you know, if you're me, you know, I see a pecan tree and I have to call somebody. You know, I got to get up and call my sponsor, right? It sets in it triggers a line of thinking and leads to a behavior that's going to end up, you know, with a particular reward, maybe gorging pecan pies, but then the negative consequences. I feel sick and get fat and all that kind of stuff. All right, so what do you do instead? Well, you have to start new habit patterns. So if for me, you know, pecan trees are a problem and this street is filled with pecan trees, I have to learn to take a new way home, right? So that I don't expose myself to those triggers. That's number one. Number two, if I have kind of a normal appetite, then I have to set up new habit patterns. I have to say, well, I'm going to make a discipline, have a rule of life where, you know, I'm going to eat this way every day. And that'll satisfy my innate hungers, but create patterns of behavior that are intrinsically healthy. And that's what you have to do. So Catholic devotional life is one way of creating those new habit patterns. If you're filling your mind with thoughts of Christ and the apostles and the saints and the Blessed Virgin Mary. You're putting the right kind of thing into your mind. And I think going easy on yourself, recognizing that those old habits, those old patterns, they're not ever going to go away. And sometimes you're going to hit those triggers through no fault of your own. You know, you're walking down the street, somebody throws something in your face that you didn't ask for, you weren't expecting. But lo and behold, there it is, that craving is initiated. You have to have a plan in advance. What am I going to do in this moment of temptation? When that strikes me, what is my out? What is my out? And, you know, if maybe you have somebody you call, maybe you have a spiritual director, maybe you have a friend, maybe you have a prayer that you consistently say. You know, years ago, I developed a pattern that I have tried on and off to implement in my life. If I'm presented with a temptation to something immoderate, I would say to myself, you know, a man of virtue doesn't do that. And I'm a man of virtue, or at least trying to become one. And I would just say that phrase to myself. And, you know, it would not completely eliminate the temptation, but it would mitigate it somewhat, kind of take the edge off of it and give me someplace else to put my mind. So you have to find little tricks like that to do on yourself. And the saints do this. Evagrius Ponticus, who was a great Egyptian monastic of the late 4th century, you know, if he got hit with the temptation to lust, for example, excuse me, I'll take that back. If he got hit with the temptation to pride, he would remind himself that he was also subject to the temptation of lust. And doing that would kind of eliminate his pride, right? He would realize, oh, I'm really actually a very weak person. I'm not a spiritual giant. And he found a way to kind of play the various temptations off against one another in an early form of cognitive behavioral therapy. Now, that worked for him, but you have to find that system that works for you.
A couple of open lines for you and plenty of time for your calls at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Rosemary is a first-time caller in the Republic of Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Rosemary, you're on with Dr. David Anders.
Thank you very much, and thank you for all you do. So my struggle is with my daughter. Every time I try to approach any Catholic issue, I don't always find the way to get her. She's mad with the church, with all the human mistakes in the church and the trajectory of the church. And so I don't know anymore what to say. Every time I approach her, she has something else to say, and I have nothing to say back.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. Well, those humans, I tell you, they're a problem. I have a problem with the humans in the church, too. And I guess if I left the church, there'd be one less human problem, right?
I don't like the way you look at me when you say that.
So, you know, this is not unusual. In fact, I know the statistics on people who leave the church, and I've read an awful lot of sociology from people who have left the church and the reasons that they give. And bad experiences with other humans, far and above one of the highest motivators for people leaving. You know, people, the media would like you to think that people leave the church because they object to Catholic doctrine. People don't object to Catholic doctrine. They really don't. What they object to are Catholics. That's what they object to. And usually it's not just one bad experience, it's many bad experiences that they've had. They've been shunned or turned away or you know, given the cold shoulder. And it happens one too many times, and they say, I'm done, and they walk away. So I'm sympathetic to the complaint, and I understand it. In my own case, bad Catholics never really dissuaded me from wanting to become Catholic, because my own personal motive in becoming Catholic was to fellowship with the good Catholics. And I mean by that Jesus and Mary and all the saints. And I figured I'd meet some living humans along the way that were pretty decent folks, and I've been blessed to know quite a lot of really decent Catholics who have inspired me. And if one treats me quite badly, then I go, well, that's not the one whose spirituality I want to follow. That's at least how I do it. Now, in terms of the question, what do you say to your daughter? In my judgment, you don't. And you're laboring under the presumption that if your daughter's left the church, that it's somehow incumbent upon you. It's your obligation to win her back. And that if you don't do so, you're a bad mother. And I don't think that's true at all. I don't think that's true at all. And you've already told me that talking to her about the faith is ineffective. I agree. It's ineffective with most people who have left the church because of bad experiences. Telling them that their bad experiences are not representative does not work. Therefore, we should stop doing it. The reason that she told you she left the church is bad experiences with humans. So the solution isn't to talk at her, it's to give her good experiences with humans, beginning with you. And so my recommendation is, rather than talking at her, you make it your intent to manifest in your behavior the kind of thing she failed to find in the church. She probably had plenty of people telling her what she should do, and not enough people listening to her and accompanying her and loving her. That's what she's telling you. So don't tell her she's wrong. Rather, accompany her, love her, and listen to her. Be the face of Christ's mercy to her. Be the contradiction to her accusation that the church is uncaring. That's vastly more important than telling her she's wrong. Show her she's wrong by manifesting the opposite behavior in your own demeanor.
Does that help, Rosemary?
Oh, my gosh. Completely. Thank you so much. God bless you guys.
Thank you.
God bless you. We appreciate the phone call. That opens up a line for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Joe is in Gregory, Michigan, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Joe, you're on with Dr. David Anders.
Hi, Dr. David. First-time caller. I'm a father of seven children, and it was a long time to where our finances weren't doing well, and in my field, I started becoming pretty good at what I do, so I decided to get a business with a couple of other partners that have actually, one has trained me to be a salesperson, and working with him, I found that even though that they proclaim that this is a faith-based company that we're doing, I started understanding that they wanted to, you know, cut on taxes this way, that was illegal, do this bad, and it was really hard working with him to boot, and I was paying for a very long time on what I should do after it started. We ended up having a house fire. All these things happened to where I couldn't be there to help build the business, even though I invested in it. And then on my way to work while I was there, I cried really hard and prayed really hard on a rosary. Please, God, give me a sign if this is what you want me to do or if you just want me to go back to working my regular job. And half hour later, the company was disbanded, and it was their decision. And then they tried to get me back and say that, you know, everybody stressed. We just started this business, and I think it was God answering my prayer. Do prayers get answered that way?
Thanks. I really appreciate the question. So try to be cautious in what I say here. Obviously, God answers prayers. Obviously, he does. And often in ways that we don't anticipate. I do think you ought to be very cautious, however, when kind of laying out a fleece and demanding a sign from God. And so you're psychologically, you become very attuned to looking for events that could be interpreted as divine signs. Then something pops into your field of vision, something into your salience landscape becomes very apparent to you, and you go, that must be the answer to the prayer. And I think you can see the problem I'm pointing to is that you've already sort of psyched yourself psychologically into the anticipation that God is somehow compelled to give you a sign, and your job is to discern where it is to be found. And the possibility of justifying, kind of looking for a supernatural way to justify what you've already determined to do on some other basis is real. Let me come back to this on the other side of the break and give you what I think is a better mode of discernment.
It's EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. It's EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. Still a couple of open phone lines for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. We're talking with Joe in the great state of Michigan, who had perhaps coincidence, perhaps answer to prayer regarding something he was seeking the Lord about?
So the issue, the specific question is, does God answer the prayer? Does God answer prayers by causing us to become aware of serendipitous events? You know, if I'm trying to discern a course in my life and then, you know, all of a sudden some sort of dramatic thing happens in my personal history, should I read that as an answer to prayer? And what prompted the question is he's trying to make a decision about whether to reinvest or reenlist in a particular business that had undergone a number of challenges. And so the first thing I said was, of course, God does answer prayer. And we have plenty of evidence in sacred scripture and sacred tradition that sometimes God answers prayers in quite dramatic ways. So we don't want to foreclose that possibility. At the same time, I'm keenly aware of a danger. And the danger is that because I'm uncomfortable with uncertainty, and I have to make decisions under uncertainty all the time, that I want a surefire way to close off that uncertainty and give myself confidence and have a basis for decision making and be able to know that God told me to do this, right? And the possibility that what I'm doing is I'm relying upon putative supernatural signs to justify what is, after the fact, really kind of a moral intuition that I have, or an intuition. But I just want to grace it with the dignity of divine causation, I'm going to fall into two psychological errors that psychologists call apophenia and pareidolia. And apophenia is the tendency to find meaning in random events. This is what makes superstition so rampant around the world. It's a pervasive psychological trait that we tend to find meaning and patterns in random data. And so it's led over the centuries to people, you know, trying to read tea leaves or astrology or cracked bones or whatever it might be. And Christians can also do this. I mean, there's a Christian form of superstition, like flipping the Bible open at random and putting your finger down and saying, well, that's what God's telling me to do right now. That's just tempting fate. That's not really discerning God's will. And so I have to gauge between these two things. And what I think is a better way for decision-making under uncertainty, and I'm not denying that God does answer prayer sometimes in astonishing ways. Samuel, Samuel, get up and come in here and let me tell you what to do. I mean, God does do that, right? But here's the normal way Christians should make decisions, and it's relying on the virtue of prudence. And this is also a supernatural gift. So one of the things that comes with the gift of grace is an infused supernatural prudence. This is ability to make decisions under uncertainty. And one of the integral parts of prudence, according to St. Thomas, is the ability to take counsel, which, of course, requires humility. And so I think a better way to make a decision is, you know, from a business point of view, well, you look at the relevant business statistics, you look at the market, you do all that stuff that good business people do. Then you talk to people that have been in the same boat. You talk to people that you respect, people who've won, people who failed in business. You seek a lot of counsel. You talk to your family about the impact on their lives, and you weigh, you know, their financial costs also against personal costs. And Joe told us that the business had taken a significant toll on him spiritually, in his conscience, and that was really what was troubling him. Well, you listen to those concerns, too. It's not just a financial decision. And then you make a decision based on information and research and discernment, and especially on the humble acceptance of counsel from people who know. And then you act. And when you use all those relevant tools, your uncertainty narrows a great deal. And you take your own personality into consideration. Maybe I'm just not the kind of person he needs to be in this business. I had dreams of being, you know, the super successful whatever, but, you know, my temperament is better in this other realm. You look at all of that, and then you make your decision. And then, you know, if God drops a sign out of you out of the sky, that's fantastic, right? But you don't start by presuming that God is going to take away from you the uncertainty of having to make up your own mind.
So if you're feeling like you should walk to work, start walking to work, and you go outside and there's a tree limb on top of your car, not necessarily a sign from God.
Right, but it might be providence keeping you from going to work.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Melissa's in Daytona Beach, Florida, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Melissa, you're on with Dr. David Anders.
Hello. Thank you, Dr. Anders, for talking with me. I have a bit of a complex situation, but I only have two questions. I've tried to narrow it down to two questions for you. I recently returned to the Catholic Church after being Protestant. So I've just come home, and I have learned recently, just in a couple of days, that my marriage is invalid. I got married while I was away from the church, and I was Catholic. I became Catholic. I was confirmed. I went away for a while and got married in a Protestant church and came back. So don't need to delve into that. But I've recently just learned that my marriage is invalid. I did not seek dispensation ahead of time. And I didn't realize that at first. There's much I don't understand. And as soon as I became aware of this, I went to confession and I confessed it. And the priest would not give me full absolution. He said that he revealed to me that I was living in sin, as the church sees it. And I needed to resolve the issue with my marriage, either have it validated or annulled, before he could give me resolution. I'm sorry, absolution. And I'm wondering if that's quite accurate. My husband and I have taken it upon ourselves to abstain until the matter is settled. And so as far as I know, I've given confession, I have done penance, and I am attempting to take responsibility for my actions, at least for my own part. It may take a while before the issue is actually resolved. I need to wait for my Protestant husband to make a decision. But for myself, I'm under the impression I've done everything that I'm obliged to. Am I entitled to absolution at this point? Is it okay for the priest to continue to refuse to give that?
I understand the dilemma. Now, I before I answer your question, I want to make a suggestion to you about your marital situation, if you would permit me to, because there is another option on the table that it sounds like you haven't considered and no one has told you about. And as you're discerning these things, I just want to make sure you have all the facts. When a Catholic is in an invalid marriage, one that could potentially become valid, right, because you don't have a previous marriage that's an impediment. It's just a matter of a lack of canonical form. And you're married to a spouse who doesn't want to come along. He doesn't want to participate in having your marriage validated in the Catholic Church. In that situation, there is a third option for Catholics like yourself, and it's called radical cenation. Radical cenation, radical meaning here at the root, right, and sanation means to render it sanitary or valid, is a way that the church can declare your marriage to be valid, even though your husband does not want to come along. Now, if your husband has another marriage floating out there in the wings, that changes the dynamic. But if both of you, if there's no impediment to a valid marriage, you can receive radical cenation without his consent, as long as he's willing to continue in marriage. And then that may render all of these things just null and void and moot, and you won't have to worry about them. So do look into that. And for whatever reason, a lot of priests don't think to mention radical cenation as a possibility. And if you bring it up to your pastor and he doesn't know what you're talking about, don't stop there. Talk to somebody on the marriage tribunal about it. Now, in terms of is the priest right to withhold absolution and communion from you? So John Paul II wrote an entire apostolic exhortation on this question, and it's called Familiaris Consortio. If you want to read John Paul's thoughts on the question, you can get a really detailed moral theological answer, and I recommend you do so. Go do some research. And basically, this is the position that when you represent yourself as married, right? I mean, in this case, you're not validly married, and the presumption is that you guys are... living the normal marital way, you're having marital relations and so forth, and because it's not a valid marriage, the church would consider that to be fornication or adultery, depending on the circumstances, and so they're not going to admit you to communion. There are situations where it becomes, it's neither possible for the couple to have their marriage convalidated, nor is it possible for them to separate. Maybe because they have children together and because of economic needs and the care of the kids, the couple has to live together, take care of the children, and they make a decision to live as brother and sister. Even though, publicly, they're not going to be walking around with a sign saying we're living as brother and sister, but the priest knows this. And so in the privacy of the confessional and the internal forum, a way is discerned for them to abstain from marital relations and to be admitted to the fellowship of the sacraments. But it is at the discretion of the priest and his discernment of your pastoral situation. And so there are priests that would, because of your decision to abstain, would say, okay, well, you've committed yourself to the idea of regularizing your marriage situation. And so your intent is to do the will of the church, and you're not having relations, and so you can participate. Another priest could, in fact, say, I'm going to hold off until you get this settled, or at least you tell me what you're going to do. And in his discernment, maybe from his point of view, he hasn't become persuaded yet that you're committed to actually doing what the church wants you to do. I don't know what his discernment is. But yeah, he does have the pastoral discernment to withhold the sacraments, but not indefinitely, not indefinitely. And it is ultimately with a kind of curative motive to help the Catholic move along the path to regularizing their marriage situation.
God bless you, Melissa, and we'll keep you in our prayers for sure. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. Next up is Tim, a first-time caller in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, listening on the EWTN app. Tim, you are on with Dr. Anders.
Thank you for taking my call, Dr. Anders. And it's a similar question as the last caller. I've been married for 25 years. My wife is a baptized Lutheran. I'm a baptized Catholic. We were married in the Lutheran church. I had a Catholic priest present, and for lack of a better word, concelebrated. He was a friend. He wasn't named by the bishop. I didn't get dispensation in any way from the local bishop. I wasn't aware of that requirement at the time. Just wanted to check on my situation.
Yeah, thanks. So if you did not get a dispensation from canonical form from the bishop, then there's a strong presumption against your marriage being valid. The presence of the Catholic priest is one of the necessary requirements for a canonical form. It would be very odd. It would be extremely odd, to say the least, for a Catholic priest to agree to officiate at a wedding in a Lutheran church if he did not have his bishop's permission. And so I hesitate to say your marriage is not valid based on a lack of canonical form without knowing all the relevant details. But it is a question to investigate. It is a question to investigate, to raise that and say, is this priest still alive, for example? Could you ask him, did you have the bishop's permission to do this? And investigate that fact. I mean, it's worth looking into.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. You know, all of our shows here on EWTN are podcast for you at EWTN's Podcast Central. And if you go to the Best of the Rest tab, we have upwards of 50 podcasts from other great Catholic sources. And one of those podcasts is called Lily. And it's drawn from hundreds of archival recordings of Alice von Hildebrand, a really treasure to the church, known to her friends as Lily. And she brings her timeless wit and charm to topics that are timely and eternal, much like our own Mother Angelica. On Lily's most recent episode, Alice von Hildebrand discusses the anti-Catholicism and misogyny that plagued her academic career, and that she still found joy in serving her students all the same. That's the podcast, Lily. It's available at EWTN's Podcast Central. Just go to EWTN.com/radio/podcast. Next up is Carol in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, watching us on YouTube today. Carol, you're on with Dr. Anders.
Hello, Dr. Anders.
Hi.
I've been watching you since pretty much you've gotten on EWTN. I thank you for all I've learned from you.
Oh, well.
I'm in a tough situation right now. I am. I have had a 42-year-old marriage to a wonderful man who about 8 years ago turned weird, and our wonderful family was kind of destroyed by his and my daughter's abuse of me. I finally left 5 years ago, and then my son became a scapegoat, and he almost took his life and finally left. Now we found out. I've been keeping in touch with him and trying to get back together with him, and I love him still, but I found out he is very sick, and he's now in the hospital looking, waiting to find out if he can get a liver. We have to be all together there to show that we're going to be a supportive family to be with him through this liver transplant. Or if he doesn't have this support, he won't get the liver. But if we came back and decided all to just put bygones be gone, whatever that saying is, and to be that family for him. But we've been staying at the hospital day and night, 2 weeks now, and I had like no sleep. The abuse started when I stayed with him at night, and I had to do all kinds of stuff that the nurses aren't doing, blah, blah, blah. But he is just very abusive to me. I know he's kind of out of his mind, but it's very, very hard. And the PTSD is just coming up, and I don't know what to do. I feel like I just want to run away. My son wants to stay, to be Jesus to them, to be like Jesus on the cross, and just do that. But he's not taking his medication. I don't know what he's going to do. And he seems like he's slipping right back into the under the spell. What should I do? What is my duty as a Catholic? I don't know what to do.
Carol, if you were my sister, and this was my brother-in-law you were talking to me about, based on what you've told me so far, what I would tell you to do is go home and take a nap. And I would say, just go, right? You told me you haven't been sleeping, you're exhausted, you're at the end of your rope. I would go home and take a nap. I really would. And I would never send my own sister into a situation where I knew that she was going to get abused by somebody, verbally or otherwise. Now, we have an obligation to forgive our enemies. I mean, that's gospel teaching. And so you want to forgive this man. You don't want him to go to his grave, you know, harboring unforgiveness against him. But forgiving someone does not mean, A, that you sign up to make yourself a doormat again, right? You don't do that. You're not naive now. You know what this is about. You don't have to let yourself be victimized. You're not actually helping him by letting yourself be victimized. In fact, at the end of his life, he doesn't need opportunities to victimize people. That's not a good place for him to be at the end of his life. So you don't have to sign up to be a victim. Secondly, forgiving someone doesn't mean that you expunge all memory of the past, nor that you expunge all pain associated with those memories. That's impossible. You're going to remember things that happened. Those memories are going to cause you pain. That's part of the human condition. You can't escape that. Asking you to is to ask the impossible, and God never asks you to do the impossible. So forgiveness means that you wish the best for him. You really want his genuine good, spiritual and physical. And to the extent that it is possible, you want to be in loving relationship and just relationship with this individual. But that means you want him to do justice to you, and you want to do justice to him. And that relationship may never be fully realized in this life, right? So you have to put safeguards in there to protect yourself and your family from abuse. But you always maintain that openness that, you know, if the opportunity presents itself for genuine reconciliation, I'm there. I'm not going to refuse to be reconciled. But neither do I have to make myself a victim. But in any event, in the short term, you're not going to make any good decisions if you're so exhausted that you can't stand up. So go home and take a nap and give yourself a break, and then come back with a clear head and see if you can go forward.
God bless you, Carol, and all of our listeners will keep you in their prayers. Next up is Andre in Trinidad watching us today on YouTube. Andre, thanks for holding. You're on with Dr. Anders.
Hi, Jack and Dr. Anders.
Hey, Andre. Good to hear from you again.
Good. Hearing the first question on your show today really triggered this question. As a teenager, I used to be addicted to daily horoscope readings. And later in my 20s, I encountered the writings of the late Sufi exponent Idris Shah, who recommended that we read every daily horoscope of every zodiac sign. And that suggestion healed me almost immediately because I could see how impractical, arbitrary, and nonsensical those so-called predictions were. What remains in my mid-60s is a tacit acceptance of patterns of human behavior and personality, according to zodiac signs. Is this paganistic? And hearing your proposal for new patterns over the old one, how can we overcome this acceptance if the church does not agree with it?
Thanks. I really appreciate the question. So the nearest analogy I have from my own experience, I was never drawn to the zodiac myself, never had any interest in that. But I was raised in a fundamentalist community that had a lot of equally wacky beliefs that were, I think, equally destructive of human dignity and human flourishing. And something that I find a need to do right, in my present life is from time to time I have to go back and read the scientific literature on religious trauma and religious abuse and fundamentalism and sort of refresh my memory about, like, I'm not just making it up. This stuff really was harmful. And here are some of the consequences of it. And it kind of steals me and grounds me again. And that's what St. Augustine did, right, 1,500 years ago with astrology. He was also caught up in a lot of superstitions as a young man. And then he subjected those superstitions to critical scrutiny, to rational and scientific analysis, and found that they were utterly wanting and that they were destructive of human dignity. And if Augustine can do that, I think we're in good company. And so, you know, some of the things you might want to look at are delve a little bit into the academic literature on pseudoscience. What is pseudoscience? Why is it attractive? How does it function? Why does it seem persuasive? I think Oxford University Press has one of their very short introductions. These are like 150 pages or so on pseudoscience. When it comes to the personality typing, so people do fall into categorical personality types. They're not correlated to astrology at all, but there is such a thing as a personality psychology. And it does have some predictive value, but it's not based again on mystic or occult forces. It's just based on genetics and environment. And so, you know, reading some of the literature in personality psychology and getting a sound way. I mean, the impulse to kind of try to put people in a box to understand them better is natural, I think, and not altogether ill-advised, as long as you go about it in a rational way. And so, you know, I think availing yourself of some of the relevant psychological literature. Catholic faith does this. I mean, there's a long a tradition in Catholic psychology of dealing with people according to their temperament and the theory of the four temperaments. And in the confessional literature, you know, there's a lot of instruction for priests about making sure you handle different souls differently. If you have a scrupulous person, you handle them one way. If you have a presumptuous person, you handle them in another way. And making those kinds of rational judgments just makes good sense. But again, it's not based on a mystic or occult forces. It's just based on natural processes.
Renee is up in Fairfax, Virginia, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Renee, just a couple minutes left with Dr. Anders. What's your question today?
Okay, thank you for taking my call, Dr. Anders. It's wonderful to talk to you. I am a little confused about the gospel narratives of the resurrection. In one of the gospels, it says that Jesus did not want Mary Magdalene to touch him because he had not yet ascended to the Father. But later on, before the ascension, didn't, for instance, Thomas stick his finger into his side and the nail holes? And in another gospel, it says that the apostles grabbed and hugged his feet and worshipped him when they recognized him.
Yes.
I am confused.
Yes. Well, interestingly enough, the tension that you note occurs in the same chapter of the same book, which is John chapter 20. So this isn't a conflict between gospel accounts. It's a tension in the same gospel account, namely St. John's gospel. And I think the context of the two remarks explains the differences. So with Mary Magdalene, obviously, don't hold on to me, I haven't yet ascended to my Father. The emphasis here is on the ascension, and that the way that we're going to encounter the risen Christ is in his body, the church, in the sacraments, in the life of the Spirit. And you know, Paul talks about, you know, knowing Christ according to the flesh, meaning the historical ministry of Jesus or not. And that's not, like, we don't have that knowledge of him anymore, and that's okay. We don't have to have knowledge of Jesus in the flesh in history, right, personally, personal interaction, to be in relationship to the living Lord. We do so through his body, the church. Now, the situation with Thomas was very different because this is someone who doubts that there could be a physical ascension because he doubts there could be a physical resurrection. And there, testifying to the physicality of the resurrection is paramount to the act of faith. That if Jesus is not raised bodily from the grave, then we won't be raised. That's what Paul says. And so you have to have faith in the physical resurrection of the then ascended Jesus.
On behalf of our host, Dr. David Anders, our producer, Charles Beery, our call screener, Matt Gubensky, and our social media maven today, Mr. Rich Jesse. I'm Jack Williams. Thanks so much for helping us answer that question. What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? We do the program every day, Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern time. We do invite you to check back in and recommend us to your friends. And until we get together next time here on EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders, God bless.